Welcome to another episode of the History of Jamaican Politics. On today's episode, we are featuring Paul Bogle in the 1865 Morant Bay Rebellion. If you are not following us, we would be honored if you would consider doing so. It costs you nothing to hit that button so that you will be notified every time we release a new episode. Now, let's get into it. It is the morning of October 11, 1865. A column of men and women is moving along a dirt road in St. Thomas in the East, the southeastern parish of Jamaica. They are coming from Stony Gut, a small village that sits in the hills not far from the coast. They are carrying sticks. Some carry cutlasses, the tools of cane labor, the blade of a working life. They are not a professional army. They are not a trained militia. They are peasants, cultivators, domestic workers, Baptist church members, the children and grandchildren of people who were enslaved, people who were told in 1838 that emancipation had set them free, and who have spent the years since then learning, yard by yard and season by season, exactly how much that freedom cost them. They are walking toward the Morant Bay Courthouse, and the man at the front of that march has already been refused once. He walked 45 miles to Spanish Town and asked a governor to hear his people's grievances. The governor sent him home. What happens next is what this episode is about. His name was Paul Bogle. He was born in Stony Gut around 1822, though the exact year is not confirmed in the historical record. He was a black man. He was a Baptist deacon. He owned land, and in a colony where the vast majority of black Jamaicans could not vote, could not access courts fairly, and could not feed their families on the wages the plantation economy offered. He was among a small group of people who had found enough ground to stand on, and he used that ground not to protect himself, but to organize. That is the thread this story plants early. Paul Bogle could have stayed quiet. He had land. He had standing in his church. He had a community that trusted him. The question running underneath this entire story is why a man with something to lose chose to put it all in front of the courthouse steps. The years between emancipation in 1838 and the rebellion in 1865 were not years of progress for the black poor of Jamaica. The sugar economy had collapsed into slow decline. Wages had fallen. Droughts had killed crops. A cholera outbreak in 1850 had moved through the parishes like a deliberate judgment. The land that freed people needed to survive was either already owned by the plantocracy or priced beyond any laborer's reach. The courts, run by the plantocracy, settled disputes in favor of the plantocracy. The assembly, dominated by the plantocracy, wrote laws that protected the plantocracy. The governor, appointed by the crown, rarely had reason to deviate from the structure that kept the colony running. This is not rhetoric. This is the documented architecture of post-emancipation Jamaica. The Morant Bay Rebellion was not born out of sudden anger. It was born out of 27 years of structured disappointment, and Paul Bogle had watched every year of it. George William Gordon was the other man, whose name is inseparable from this story. Gordon was a free colored man. Born around 1820, the son of an enslaved woman and a white planter, he had risen through commerce to wealth, had won a seat in the House of Assembly, and had become a vocal critic of the colonial government's treatment of the black and mixed-race poor. He established a native Baptist church, where Paul Bogle served as a deacon. Gordon and Bogle were not of the same class, but they were united by conviction. Gordon used Parliament. Bogle used the community. Together, they were what the colonial government feared most, a legal voice and a ground-level movement working in the same direction at the same time. Governor Edward John Eyre had taken over the governorship of Jamaica in 1862. He was not a man who read the ground well. His predecessor had at least engaged with some of the economic petitions.
Eyre dismissed them.
When Bogle and the people of Stony Gut walked 45 miles to Spanish Town in August 1865 to present their grievances directly to the governor, Eyre refused to meet them. He sent a message instead. It told them to rely on their own efforts. It told them the government could do nothing for them. The silence from the colonial government was itself a message, and Bogle heard it clearly. When he returned to Stony Gut, something had changed. Not immediately, not all at once, but the march to Spanish Town had tested the limits of petition, of patience, of the belief that the colonial system could be moved by the voices of the poor asking respectfully, it had found those limits, and the community of Stony Gut began preparing for something different, a confrontation at a local court case in Morant Bay on October 7, 1865, was the immediate trigger. Two of Bogle's followers were being tried. A crowd had gathered. A black man named James G.O. Geegan intervened when police tried to arrest a boy accused of interfering with proceedings. Police attempted to detain G.O. Geegan. The crowd surrounded them. G.O. Geegan escaped. Warrants were issued for Bogle and other men from Stony Gut. 4 days later, Paul Bogle led the march. On the morning of October 11, two large organized groups arrived at the Morant Bay Courthouse. Records confirm they were mainly cultivators, armed with sticks and cutlasses. The custos of the parish, Baron von Kettelhold, stood on the portico of the courthouse and addressed the crowd. The volunteer militia was drawn up in front of the building. What happened next was fast and violent. The militia fired on the crowd. Seven people were shot and killed. The crowd surged. The courthouse was burned. The custos was killed. Multiple militia members died. The fire spread to nearby buildings. By the time the night settled over St. Thomas, in the east, October 11 had become one of the most consequential dates in Jamaican history. Not because of what happened at the courthouse alone, but because of what came after. Governor Eyre declared martial law on October 13. He directed military troops, and in a decision that carries its own painful weight in the historical record, he enlisted the Maroons of Moortown to assist in suppressing the rebellion. Maroons, who had won their freedom through resistance and treaty, were now deployed against black Jamaicans who were doing what the Maroons themselves had once done. That irony has never fully left the memory of what happened in October 1865. What followed was not a suppression, it was a massacre. Soldiers moved through the parishes of St. Thomas in the east with near total impunity under martial law. They did not confine their violence to armed rebels. They killed broadly. They burned homes. They destroyed livestock and crops. More than 400 black Jamaicans were killed directly by soldiers. 354 more were arrested and executed, some without any trial at all. 60 people were flogged under sentences that left permanent damage. Thousands of homes were burned across the parish. The crowd heard the promise. History kept the bill. Paul Bogle was captured by a Maroon party and brought back to Morant Bay. He was tried under martial law. He was hanged on October 24, 1865, inside the very courthouse he had marched toward 2 weeks before. He was approximately 43 years old. George William Gordon was arrested in Kingston, a city where martial law was not in force. Eyre had him physically transported to Morant Bay, where martial law did apply. Within 2 days, Gordon was tried for high treason by court-martial, without due process of law, convicted on suspicion of having planned the rebellion, and executed on October 23. He was hanged the day before Bogle. This is the midpoint of this story, and this is where the mystery thread resurfaces. The question of whether George William Gordon actually planned or coordinated the rebellion has never been settled. Governor Eyre was certain. He told London as much. But historians and the eventual Royal Commission of Inquiry reached a different conclusion. The question was not whether Gordon supported Bogle and the people of Stony Gut. He clearly did. The question was whether his support constituted conspiracy to rebellion, and the evidence for that specific charge was thin, contested, and produced under martial law conditions designed to move fast and not to be careful. The silence of the record at that point, the absence of confirmed coordination between Gordon and Bogle beyond their shared church and shared convictions, is the silence the colonial government needed to disappear a man whose voice in Parliament had been inconvenient for years. The rebellion spread the news fast across the Atlantic. In Britain, the reaction was sharp and divided. A Jamaica committee formed, led by intellectuals and abolitionists, calling for Eyre to be prosecuted for murder. A rival group, the Eyre Defense and Aid Committee, rallied to his support. The debate tore through British public life. Eyre was recalled as governor in June 1866. He was never prosecuted. The Jamaica Committee's legal efforts collapsed in the courts, Eyre returned to England, a private citizen, and lived until 1901. But the consequences of the rebellion went far beyond what happened to Eyre. In November 1865, the Jamaican House of Assembly voted to dissolve itself. It is a remarkable moment in colonial constitutional history. The very body that had defended planter power and excluded black Jamaicans from political life for two centuries voted itself out of existence. The old representative system was abolished. Jamaica became a crown colony, governed directly from London. It was not democracy, it was not justice, but it was the end of the plantocracy's formal control over Jamaican governance. The constitutional change that followed brought reforms in education, public health, infrastructure, and local government that the Assembly had blocked for decades. The Morant Bay Rebellion did not win freedom for the black poor of Jamaica, but it broke the structure that had kept them precisely where the plantation economy needed them, and no one could rebuild that structure the same way again. Paul Bogle's full significance was not recognized in his own lifetime. For nearly a century, the official story treated the rebellion as a riot, a breakdown of colonial order, a problem that had been correctly suppressed. The men who died trying to change the conditions of black Jamaican life were recorded as criminals. In 1965, 100 years after the rebellion, a statue of Paul Bogle, sculpted by Edna Manley, wife of Norman Manley and mother of Michael Manley, was erected in front of the Morant Bay Courthouse. In 1969, Paul Bogle was officially named a National Hero of Jamaica. George William Gordon was named alongside him. The ceremony acknowledged something that the colonial record had spent a century refusing to say out loud. These men had been right, and the state that killed them had been wrong. The statue stood in front of that courthouse until February 19, 2007, when the historic courthouse was destroyed by fire. Not by rebellion this time, but by accident, the statue survived. It was placed in storage and later returned to the site of a new courthouse completed in 2014. The Morant Bay Courthouse has been proposed as a museum site. The walls of the original structure, scorched brick from a building that has now seen two fires across a century and a half, still stand at the edge of the town of Morant Bay in St. Thomas. The crowd heard the promise. History kept the bill. Paul Bogle walked 45 miles to ask a governor to listen. The governor sent him home. He walked back through St. Thomas, knowing the answer. He built a community of resistance in a church in Stony Gut. He led a march to a courthouse steps, knowing the risk. He was captured, tried in hours, and hanged inside the building he had marched toward. And 100 years later, the independent Jamaica he helped make possible put his face on the $2 coin and called him a national hero. The man was not a failure. The man was not simply a riot leader. He was the clearest possible signal that the post-emancipation colonial order had run out of time, and the signal was delivered the only way the colonial government had left available. That was the story of Paul Bogle and the 1865 Morant Bay Rebellion. If this episode moved you, if it taught you something, if it made you look at Jamaica's history differently, share it. Follow us if you have not already, and stay close, because on the next episode of the History of Jamaican Politics, we are going somewhere you are not ready for.